Welcome to Pop Culture Retro, which was recently voted the 15th best podcast by the residents of the Golden Years Retirement Community in Boca Raton, Florida. Each show, we'll revisit some of your favorite pop culture memories with insider and outsider perspectives. Now, please help me welcome your hosts, Ike Eisenman and Jonathan Rosen.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Pop Culture Retro. I'm one of your hosts, Jonathan Rosen, along with Ike Eisenman. And today we are thrilled to welcome someone who's been a professional writer for over 40 years. He's written for Dick Cavett and such shows as Simon and Simon, Murder, She Wrote, and Sliders. He's also the author of the fascinating memoir, Raised Eyebrows, My Years Inside Groucho's House. Please help us welcome Steve Stolyar. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
It is a pleasure, and I don't know why you needed help welcoming me. You did a fine job yourself.
Well, just in case. Well, your book, Raised Eyebrows, I read it this week, is about your time spent with Groucho. You grew up a big Marx Brothers fan as well. And right. I know for me, there were certain movies that I watched with my dad, like the Marx Brothers, Hope and Crosby, Woody Allen. Were the Marx Brothers something that you was passed on to you from your family, or was just you became a fan of theirs on your own?
Well, there were certain hints about them before I was aware of them, because my parents would say things like, you must have been vaccinated with a phonograph needle, which I thought was clever until I realized my mom had heard it in Marx Brothers movie. Also, I had an Uncle Joe, who was my mom's brother, who was a balding man with a gray mustache and glasses and smoked a cigar and wiggled his eyebrows and was funny. So when I was finally introduced to, you know, You Bet Your Life, I kind of wondered why the host was imitating my Uncle Joe. I had for the longest time loved old movies, and that doesn't mean Titanic or Star Wars. That like from the 30s or silent movies. I enjoyed, you know, Chaplin and Keaton and Lloyd and Laurel and Hardy. Mm-hmm. And it was in high school that I really became fully aware of the Marx Brothers and wondered where they'd been hiding all my life. And immediately set out to try to see as many of their movies as I could, which, you know, they only made about a dozen. They weren't like Laurel and Hardy making dozens and dozens of shorts, silent and sound and feature films, or the Three Stooges making shorts for 25 years, cranking them out. There's only this precious dozen or so movies. And of course, back in the late 60s and early 70s, you couldn't take out a pocket device and punch sure. in YouTube. You couldn't turn to Turner Classic Movies. You couldn't order off Amazon a box set or a DVD or a VHS or anything. You just had to be lucky if they were going to cycle through on TV late night. I would just will myself to stay awake past Carson and past The Tomorrow Show into the netherworld of local car commercials and just make myself stay awake. And I saw a lot of classic films that way. And then they would occasionally show up at revival houses in the city, but it wasn't really a popular thing, revival houses with film festivals and all that. It really was a matter of like getting that week's TV guide and going through it and circling it and then slowly crossing it off the list.
Yeah, but I was going to say the TV guide was the most valuable tool of the day because you could at least figure out beforehand when these films were going to be on. That was a big deal for me too. Sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, assuming that some of your viewers and listeners are Gen X and younger, it requires a little explaining now that everything is at everyone's fingertips all the time with no effort and often at no cost, that it was catch as catch can or can't back then. And of the Marx Brothers, Groucho was immediately my favorite. His sense of humor dovetailed perfectly with my affinity for wordplay, which again was from more from my mother's side of the family than my father's. Because my mom would tell me stories about her dad, who I never knew. He died before I was born. But he apparently had the driest imaginable sense of humor and was constantly fooling my grandmother by saying things. It's like they would be driving along and he would say, "Oh, that's where Henry's Tailor Shop is." And she would say, "You've heard of Henry's Tailor Shop?" "No." And he would say things like, "People are dying today who never died before." Yeah, I'm sorry I never met him, but that gene was passed down to my mom, who also loved, rather than, you know, my father's sense of humor was long stories that were rarely worth the journey.
Oh, no.
Ernie goes into the delicatessen and says, "I want you to shorten these trousers." And the butcher says, "This isn't a tailor shop." So Bernie goes back the second, you know, those kind of things that it's like, I like get in, get the laugh, get out. One-liners, two-liners. And that's much closer to my mom's sense of humor and Groucho's sense of humor. You know, people will ask me about, you know, jokes that he told. And he really, in real life, he didn't really tend to say, you know, two Irishmen walk into a bar. He didn't do that. He just said clever things, puns, double entendres, you know, twisting clever things around. And some of that rubbed off on me, and some of that was there to begin with. The you know, let's discuss the nature and nurture approach to comedy. That'll put them to sleep. But, you know, and Steve Allen had the same thing. That sort of, you know, looking at a strange phrase and dissecting it, you know, like you're more than welcome. How can you be more than welcome? Yeah, I mean, you're either welcome or you're not welcome. Or, you know, I would say, like, you know, I did an interview with him once for a school project and was asking him about who he liked in television. "Me. Who do you like?" "And then me." And I said, "What about movies?" And he said, "Movies, they're good. Yeah, they ought to make a lot of them." or I was on early on, Erin Fleming, the controversial actress that had become in charge of his life, suddenly put him on the phone, and I wasn't prepared for it. I said, "How's Groucho?" And she said, "Well, here, you can ask him." "Hello?" And I said, "Hi, Groucho, how are you doing?" "How am I doing what?" "How are you doing whatever you're doing?" "I'm telephoning. What are you doing?" I'm telephoning too. It certainly is a small world." "Yes, it is. Well, I'll let you speak with Miss Fleming." So that thing about taking literally what someone says, you know, or I would say there's an election around the corner. "Around which corner?" "You can't just say around the corner. It has to be a specific one." So that, you know, it was an instant attraction. Sure. And I figured there was less than no chance I would ever be able to meet this man, because he was in his 80s and had had some health problems. And somehow, through an extraordinary set of circumstances.
That's what I wanted to ask you about that. Before you get to that, that's the Harry Ruby one. That's the one that... The book details your experiences growing up, and it shows that you were obsessive.
I was an obsessive fan. You know, obsessive fans now tend to stab or shoot their idols, or insist that they're married to them or want to marry them. and no one else can have them. I wasn't that bad, but I was only a notch or two below that level, because I would hear about, you know, oh, we saw Groucho walking in a park in Beverly Hills. And I thought, why wasn't that me? And we had heard that he liked to eat at a place in, no longer there in Beverly Hills, called Jacopo's Pizzeria. So my roommate and I went there one day, and we saw they had a Groucho special on the menu. But, you know, if you go to Cantor's, they've still got like an Eddie Cantor special decades after he died. So, so I said to the waitress, you have a Groucho special on the menu, but I mean, does he really come in here? And she said, oh yes, he was here. Let me see. He was here yesterday, and he was here right after we opened, and he tried to pay with $100 bill, and he always does that. And he knows we can't make change. He's so funny. And I thought, why is this experience wasted on a pizzeria waitress? Why do I need to be? And I thought, you know, should we camp out somewhere under the, and I mean, it was very frustrating. And I had no idea how you go about meeting your hero.
Well, can you explain who Harry Ruby was for people who don't know? And
oh, yes.
Yep.
Well, all right. In December of 73, which is more than 50 years.
Wow. Yep.
God, I can't handle that. Yes, more than half a century ago, I heard that there was a print of Animal Crackers playing at a small theater in Orange County. Now, Animal Crackers had been the Marx Brothers' second film, and it was based on their successful Broadway play. And for some reason, which I didn't know at the time, it just wasn't seen anywhere. It wasn't part of MCA's syndicated package of old Paramount films. It didn't show up at revival houses. It didn't show up on TV. And it was considered one of their best movies. Groucho was Captain Spaulding, and that's where his theme song came from, and the I Shot an Elephant in My Pajamas joke and all that. And so a bunch of friends and I piled into a car and drove down, and it was a horrible, dupey, bootleg, murky print. Mm. But it was Animal Crackers, and we were amazed to be seeing it. And I thought, in my innocence, I'd like to let Groucho Marx know that this is playing here, because maybe he hasn't seen it in years either. So I knew Groucho's phone number was not in the Beverly Hills phone book, no surprise. But having nosed around in it once, I knew that Harry Ruby's phone number was listed. Harry Ruby was one of Groucho's oldest friends, and he was a composer and screenwriter, comedy writer, that had worked on Animal Crackers and Horse Feathers. And, you know, he wrote Everyone Says I Love You and also I Want to Be Loved by You, and Three Little Words. And I thought, I'm going to see if I can tell Harry Ruby to tell Groucho about this screening. So I called the number, and he didn't answer, but a nurse answered. And because it was a nurse and not him, everything that happened after that happened. If he had answered the phone, there would have been no reason to take down my phone number to call me back, and none of my life would not have changed the way it did. So shortly after, Harry Ruby called me, and at the time, it was the most exciting thing that ever happened to me, because this was one degree of separation. Hmm. This was one of Groucho's closest friends since at least the 20s. I think they may have actually met in vaudeville before that. And I told him about it, and he said, well, I'll surely give Grouch the message. And I thought, oh my God, he's going to give. So on New Year's Day of 1974, I received a call from Aaron Fleming. And I knew, because of my obsession with Groucho, and reading the latest magazines and newspaper reports about Groucho, that she was this young, attractive woman that he was squiring around and was his companion. And again, one degree of separation. And instead of being grateful with the information, I ended up getting interrogated. How were they able to show it? It's illegal for them to be able to show it. Where did they get their print? How did you? And it's like, lady, I'm just trying to do a good deed here. And so we talked a while, and you know, it was kind of thrilling again because, wow, her picture and Groucho's were on the cover of Esquire a year earlier. And I said, while I have you on the phone, there's something that's been, I've been wondering about. Some of the books I've read say Groucho was born in 1895 and some say 1890. Which is it? And I hear, Groucho, when were you born?
October 2nd, 1890.
And she said, did you hear? And I said, yes. He's like, oh my God, he's sitting with her there. And she said that they had to leave because they were going to see Woody Allen's Sleeper. But she wanted to stay in touch because her original plan was she wanted to take me with her to Universal into MCA President Sidney Sheinberg's office and say, this young man and his friends drove all the way to Anaheim during a gas crisis to see this movie. There is an audience for it. Because as it turns out, what had happened was basically due to a clerical error, the rights to the film had expired without being renewed by Paramount and had reverted back to the writers and composers of the original play, George Kaufman, Maury Riskin, Harry Ruby, and Burt Kalmar. And so when the old Paramount films were sold to MCA Universal in the late 50s, it was included, but Universal didn't have the right to do anything with it unless they wanted to spend the money to untangle the legal knot. And their thinking was, I guess understandably, why spend good money on an old black and white Marx Brothers movie when we're spending money on big important films like Downhill Racer and Airport 74. So she was going to take me there. And in the meantime, between that phone call and the next time I talked to her, some friends and I had thought, why don't we start a petition drive at UCLA, where I was a history major, to try to multiply the striking power of, instead of just bringing this kid in and saying, yes, I went to see it because it was very funny and you should bring it out. There could be dozens and hundreds of people saying, yes, we demand. And so friends and I formed the Committee for the Re-release of Animal Crackers. And we had a table on Bruin Walk at UCLA, which is the main entrance where people make a big trek up a hill towards all the buildings where the classrooms are. And that's also where all of the organizations that had causes had a table. So there was gay rights, there was ending the Vietnam War, Hare Krishna's, legalizing marijuana. Things don't change much over the decade. And then there was this table trying to get an old Marx Brothers movie off the shelf. And I arranged with Aaron Fleming for Groucho to come to UCLA one of the days we had our table. And she and Groucho's press agent let the press know. And there were dozens and dozens of tennis-shod, long-haired, t-shirted, blue-jeaned kids milling around because they had heard that Groucho Marx was going to be coming to school. And sure enough, they showed up, and there he was in his familiar beret and turtleneck. And I shook his hand and said, "Groucho, I am very happy to be meeting you after all this time." It was an understatement. And he said, "Well, you should be." And Aaron said, "This is Steve Stolier. He's the one who is trying to get Animal Crackers re-released into theaters." And Groucho said, "Well, did you get it?" And I said, not yet, but we're working on it." And he said, "Well, you better or I'll fire you." And I said, I didn't even realize I was working for you. How much are you paying me?" And he said, "A little less than nothing." And it's like, I'm sitting here talking back and forth, and my heart is pounding out of my shirt, and I'm just trying to focus on making sense, because there's microphones thrust in our faces and cameras covering all this for news, local news, and UPI and AP photographers. And I mean, it was very exciting talking about our cause. And Groucho said that he was flattered by all the attention and being embraced by the younger generation because of the craziness of the Marx Brothers. And
it's amazing that an 80-year-old was such an icon to all these college students.
Well, it started, I think, in the late 60s, certainly before Aaron Fleming was aboard. And the, you know, the baby boomers that were protesters and don't trust anyone over 30 was a popular motto then. And they, you know, they thumbed their nose at authority. You know, there were the, you know, anti-Nixon, you know, all the caricatures of him. And here was Groucho thumbing his nose at authority and saying the things you wish you could say, but you'd get in trouble. So there was a resurgence of interest in the Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields and Mae West in the late 60s and early 70s, because they were these, you know, the material remained remarkably fresh, and they were three comedians that, you know, didn't hold back on saying what they thought. They were all outspoken and funny and clever. And I found out in a film class that I was taking at the time at UCLA that the three biggest money-making comedy stars of the early 30s weren't the Marx Brothers, Mae West, and Fields. It was Eddie Cantor, Will Rogers, and Joey Brown, who, you know, collectively had about a dozen fans still alive in the early 70s. But because of this embracing of anti-establishment anarchy, all of a sudden the Marx Brothers were hot again. And since Chico and Harpo had died in the early 60s, there was Groucho, although the straight men from the act in vaudeville and in the early films, Gummo and Zeppo, were still alive, but they, you know, didn't make any movies, and living in retirement in Palm Springs. So I should rewind a little bit. In late 72, Groucho was touring in a one-man show, and I went to see him at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. The tickets were $9.50, which won't even get your car parked there now, but at the time, it was the top price for a ticket. And my roommate and I were sitting, we got the best seats we could, which is to say towards the back of this vast theater. But it was galvanizing seeing Groucho shuffle out and start to talk. And I hadn't been prepared for how old he'd gotten, because the press had sort of conspired to keep alive the idea that good old Groucho at 82, just as sharp and funny as ever. And instead, this old, slow man came out to the podium and started reading off 3x5 cards. And it was kind of heartbreaking to realize how far he'd fallen, but nevertheless, I thought, oh my God, I'm in the same room, however cavernous, as Groucho Marx. And I applauded so hard, my hands stung the next morning from having clapped so hard. But I wanted, again, the obsessive fan, I wanted the vibrations from my hands to reach his eardrums, because I knew for a fact that that was as close as I would ever get to my hero. Then after the show, I was in the parking garage and I spotted Zeppo with a years younger blonde trying to find his car. And I thought, well, I'm never ever going to meet Groucho, but damn it, I'm going to meet a Marx brother. And again, I knew what he looked like because I had seen recent photos of him. So even though everyone else was streaming past him, he was, to me, instantly recognizable, especially with that equine profile he had. Hmm. So I went up to him and I said, excuse me, Mr. Marx, I just wanted to let you know how much I enjoyed you in your films. And he said, you weren't enjoying me. You were enjoying my brothers. Hmm. And I thought, well, I'm so glad I took the time to deliver this compliment to you, jerk. But I had met a Marx brother and I had seen Groucho and I was a happy kid.
So you had a lot of information. You had a lot of interaction with Erin. So how did it go from your interactions with her to like actually going to work there? I mean,
well, Universal relented. It's like they humored us. They cleared the rights and they said, we'll put it out in two theaters, one in Westwood and one in New York, and that's it. And we don't want to hear any more about this old movie. So they had a premiere at the UA Westwood. I rented a tuxedo. It was a thrill to be there. And, you know, the Animal Crackers campaign kids were there and were acknowledged for the work that we did to get the film out again. And Groucho was there. And it ended up breaking the house record of the UA Westwood that had been set several years earlier by the French Connection, which was very gratifying. And when I passed the theater in the coming days and weeks, it was great to see this long line of kids waiting patiently to buy tickets to see this old 1930 movie. And, you know, we certainly proved Universal wrong. So in the summer of 74, I had three summer jobs fall through, for which I remain eternally grateful. And with my dad saying, I don't want you sitting around on your fanny. You go find something. Go to Taco Bell, might want someone. I saw a sign at the tire store, and I thought, I don't want to do that. And so I thought, I have nothing to lose. And also, I just didn't want the connection broken after having tasted Groucho's company and the excitement of getting the film out. But, you know, my purpose had been, you know, fulfilled. And so why would they stay in touch with me? So I called Erin and I said, is there anything at all that you think I might possibly make? And she said, well, I used to be Groucho's secretary, but now I'm his manager. And because of all the interest in Groucho recently, there's so much fan mail, I can't begin to get to it. And we also need someone who really knows their Marx Brothers to organize all of Groucho's memorabilia, which is going to be donated to the Smithsonian eventually. And I'm thinking, oh God, please, oh God, please, oh God, oh God, please. And as I had mentioned before to someone, it was like a Tex Avery cartoon where she's still explaining the job to me on the phone and I'm ringing the doorbell in Beverly Hills. On my it was like, say no more, I'm there.
Wow.
And walking through the front door, it was like Dorothy going from sepia to Technicolor in Wonderland. It was like, oh my God, here's, you know, right by the door was a hat rack that had, you know, his berets and different hats. And next to that was a giant painting of the four Marx brothers, painted by John Decker, who was one of John Barrymore and W.C. Fields' drinking buddies. And Decker had made them look as if it had been done by, like, Van Dyck or Rembrandt. And the photos lining the walls of the Marx brothers as kids and out of makeup and with famous people, and letters from Irving Berlin and Harry Truman and Groucho's honorary Oscar, which he had only received a few months earlier. And just, it was, I couldn't believe I was being paid money to immerse myself in all this stuff.
Hmm.
In addition to all of the fan mail, which was substantial, catching up with stuff they hadn't gotten to and keeping up with the stuff that kept coming in because of the new interest, because of the Animal Crackers reissue, because You Bet Your Life had been re-syndicated again. And, you know, Groucho got letters from people saying, I saw your show. I play the bagpipe, and I would be happy to donate all of my winnings to the veterans of foreign war if you'll have me on. And I would have to write polite letters saying, Dear Mr. Kilpatrick, the shows you're watching are from the 1950s. It's like, didn't he wonder why everyone is dressed in big coats and padded shoulders? And anyway, that was part of my job, was responding to queries and just the closets were bursting with boxes filled with letters and clippings and scripts with Groucho's annotations and family photos and scrapbooks that his previous wives had kept in vaudeville and Broadway. And I couldn't believe I was being paid to do this.
Well, you sort of mentioned one, but what is some of the stranger fan mail that Groucho received?
Well, I never knew, you know, it was up to me to show him certain letters. If it was just going to be, you know, Dear Mr. Marx, you are my favorite comedian. I have seen all of your movies. I would like an autograph. Will you, you know, I'm not going to bother him with that. But every now and again, there'd be something like, my father was the chauffeur for you and your brothers back in New York, or I have a horse that I named after you, or I've seen, you know. And there was one I didn't bother showing him that said, did you develop your trademark walk trying to conceal an erection? You know, I mean, Groucho indulged in a lot of double entendres on film and in person and amongst his fellow comedians, he could be raunchy. You know, you hear the stories of and hear the tapes from the Friars Roast. They just were absolutely filthy. But Groucho, a Victorian from 1890, when in fact Victoria was still had 11 years left on the throne in England, He drew the line at what was appropriate for strangers or for the audience, and that is why he didn't really appreciate the vulgar. He didn't like dirty comedians because he said, a dirty laugh is an easy laugh. He appreciated the clever line and said, just to come out and say dirty words and people giggling at that doesn't really require much. Mm-hmm. But I think he probably would have bristled if I had brought that one in, but I do remember it now, half a century later.
Well, out of curiosity, what is your favorite Marx Brothers film? And also what was Groucho's?
Lately, I have come to realize, and I don't know why I didn't before, and I've never heard anyone else mention it, but as a rule, the more the title of a Marx Brothers movie has to do with the story, the less funny it is. A big store at the circus, room service, a day at the races, compared to Animal Crackers, Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, Duck Soup, which were their funniest movie. My favorite is Duck Soup, although there's this magic holy trinity of Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, and Duck Soup, all made 31, 32, 33, one after the other, that I think, and the real purists who can be irritating, but too bad, prefer to even Tonight at the Opera, which has much to recommend it, because of the craziness and anarchy of those loose Paramount films. The first two films were Coconuts and Animal Crackers, which are a little stiff for two reasons. One is they were based on stage plays, so there's a certain staginess to it, understandably. The other is they were shot in the Astoria Paramount Studios in New York, and they had stationary microphones. They did not have a boom yet. So Monkey Business was the first film in Hollywood and the first one that used a boom. And I watched it again last week, actually, and still find things to get to laugh at after all these viewings. But it's like they were shot out of a cannon. The minute they're discovered as the stowaways on board the ship, man, they're just racing around the ship and ducking into this room and then back to racing around the ship. And but it just, they're go and quipping all the way, and, you know, a material of a very high order, partly due to the fact that S.J. Perelman, one of the 20th century's greatest humorists, was one of the writers on that. So if someone says any of those three is their favorite, they're fine with me. Business, Horse Feathers, Duck Soup.
But what about Groucho?
Well, Groucho's answer shifted. He tended to say Night at the Opera and Day at the Races. And again, I am not saying that they're poor movies or not very good, anything like that. There's a whole lot of good stuff in both of them. However, after their Paramount contract expired with Duck Soup, Irving Thalberg, the boy genius producer from MGM, said, I could make a picture with you boys that'll have half as many laughs and make twice as much money. And he was right on both counts, for better or for worse. His complaint was that in the Paramount films, there's so many jokes, people are still laughing and don't have a chance to hear the next joke. So he wanted to slow things down. And also he wanted stronger stories. Let's have the Marx Brothers fighting to defeat the bad guy and help the hero get the girl. And we'll have splendiferous production numbers. And, you know, people are going to get a lot for their money. And he was right for the mid-30s. That is what audiences wanted to see, to forget their depression woes for their whatever 15-cent ticket or whatever it was. And I think Day at the Races was their biggest moneymaker, followed closely by Night at the Opera. So the sequel made more than the initial film. Mm-hmm. And Groucho always cited Night at the Opera and Day at the Races. And I don't know if it's purely on the basis of the quality of the film or the fact that they had gone to MGM, which, even though there were fabulous stars at all the studios, MGM was the Rolls Royce of studio. You know, their motto was more stars than there are in heaven. And they had Gable and Crawford and Garbo and Robert Taylor. And I mean, just, you know, it really was the biggest stars. And so to have Irving Thalberg, who was like this boy genius over at MGM, invite them over and treat them, you know, as first class talents with big budget movies, that had to have meant the world to those guys, especially since they lost their Broadway fortune in the stock market crash in 29 and had to start rebuilding. So all of a sudden things were lavish. Although even Groucho realized that the lavishness of MGM could go too far sometimes. There was a man named Sam Marks who was in charge of no relation, believe it or not, to any of the Marks, but he was in charge of the writers at MGM and had extraordinary stories and wrote a book about it. And I got to meet him once, and he actually took me to lunch at the commissary at MGM and introduced me to Terry Moore and Audrey Totter, a couple of film noir queens. Anyway, he said, and I don't think this was in any of the other books, he said when they were making Night at the Opera, MGM spent a bunch of money building a trick trombone for Harpo to use in one scene where all sorts of different gadgets on it do all sorts of things. And then eventually they decided, we really don't need this. The movie's tight enough as it is. We're not going to do the scene with the trick microphone, trick trombone. So the prop guy asked Sam Wood, the director, what should we do with the trombone? And Sam Wood said, well, it can't be used for any other movie. It was just made for this one. So throw it away. And Groucho said, no, gold plate it and then throw it away. That's the way MGM does things. So he was nobody's fool. And then when the boomers embraced the anarchy of the Paramount films, some of those titles started drifting into Groucho's answer to what's your favorite?
Oh, well,
you know, when we were doing the Animal Crackers campaign and someone said, what's your favorite? And Groucho said, well, I guess Animal Crackers and Duck Soup and Night at the Opera and Day at the... So it shifted a little, but for the most part, it was those two films. Mm-hmm. Now, Groucho's daughter, Miriam, had said that she laughed more at Alan Jones and Kitty Carlisle singing in Night at the Opera than she did at her dad. She, of the three children Groucho had, Miriam inherited the brilliance. And I had other family members confirm that. And she could have a wicked sense of humor. She came home from having gone to see the movies with some friends in the late 30s. And Groucho said, what'd you see? And she said, the Ritz Brothers. Now they're really funny. So imagine what that must have been like. So that's the short answer to favorite March Brothers.
Well, you did get to meet, I mean, Chico and Harpo had already passed by the time you got to that, but you did get to meet Gummo and Zeppo. So what were their experiences like, you know, with you meeting them?
Well,
you have one great story in the book about, you know, Zeppo like hitting on one of your ex-girlfriends.
What? How can you say something like that? Well, now, my experience with Zeppo up to that point, of course, had been, you weren't enjoying me, you were enjoying my brothers in the garage of the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. So I didn't, and I had read that he could be pretty curt with people. Mm-hmm. There was an interview with him in the Marx Brothers scrapbook that came out in 1973. And there's all sorts of things like, I don't want to talk about that. You're making me repeat myself. You must already know all about that. And it's like, he just seemed like this surly guy, and I, you know, confirmed by my experience. But one evening, Aaron Fleming said, Zeppo's coming up from Palm Springs. Why don't you stay to dinner? Then you can meet him. And I said, well, actually, I have a date tonight. And she said, bring her. And I thought, ooh, this is, I'm intrigued by this. Because the young lady I was going with was unflappable and old beyond her years. And I thought, this'll make an impression. So I picked her up and she said, where are we going? And I said, it's a little out of the way place. And I started snaking the car up Hillcrest Road. And she said, I know where we're going and I don't want to do this. And I said, too bad. So Linda was her name. Linda and I had dinner with Groucho and Aaron, and Zeppo was absolutely enchanted by her. She was young, she had long blonde hair and very bright and personable. And he was quite charmed. And, you know, he sort of picked up where Chico left off in terms of gambling and womanizing. And he was just coming off a divorce from his wife, Barbara, who dumped him to marry Frank Sinatra. And she became Barbara Sinatra. So he was, you know, a bachelor. And he, at one point he said, you know, Steve, you and Linda ought to come down to Palm Springs and visit sometime. And I said, well, I don't know. I was there once when I was 8 and it was sweltering. And he said, well, when did you go, during the summer? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you know, Steve, it's cold in Alaska during the winter too. Okay. So a few months later, she and I had gone our separate ways and I was taking it rough. And I had just picked up a couple of photos showing Groucho and Zeppo. And I thought, oh, this is good. I could get them to sign it. And no one will wonder why Chico and Harpo didn't sign it because they're the only ones in the picture. So I sent it to him in Palm Springs with a cover letter saying, by the way, Linda and I broke up. And I know you've been around the block a few times. If you have any advice for the lovelorn. A couple days later, the phone rings. Steve Zeppo mocks. Is this a bad time? No. What? He said, listen, I got the photographs. God, I was good looking back then. Listen, I don't want to step on your toes, you understand, but do you think that Linda would go out with me? And I thought, this is really weird. I mean, I'm asking for advice for the lovelorn, and he wants her number. And he said, if this is at all awkward for you, the last thing I would want to do is hurt you. No. She enjoyed meeting you. And I said, let me find out and get back to you. So I called Linda, and she too thought it was really odd, but again, she was intrigued at the idea of going on a date with one of the Marx brothers. I mean, as an experience. She was 19, I was 20, he was 74.
Oh my gosh.
So they went out once. He took her to dinner in San Diego and then to attend a Hialeah game in Tijuana. I guess that was his standard first date, dinner in San Diego, Hialeah in Tijuana. And when I talked to him afterwards, he said, Steve, I want you to know, I never even kissed a goodnight. She was very nice, but all she did was talk about herself. And then I saw her on campus. And she said, Zeppo was very nice, but all he did was talk about himself. And then whenever Zeppo would be up for either dinner or party at Groucho's or something, he would make a point of dragging someone over and introducing me and saying, this is Steve. He's a very nice fella. He and I dated the same girl, but he got further with it than I did. So quite an evolution in my relationship with Zeppo from the garage to Groucho, you know, working for his brother. Gummo was very soft-spoken, but also had a sense of humor. Let's see. Groucho had a cook named Robin, who was tall and slender and blonde. And Zeppo and Gummo were up to dinner at Groucho's. And I was there that night too. And Zeppo said, Robin said she'll marry me, but I think she's too tall for me. And Aaron said, what part of her do you want? And he said, I'll take as high up as I can reach. And then Gummo said, what do you want with her feet? That, you know, it's a brilliant line. I mean, it's an absurd Marx Brothers line that he's so short that as high as he could reach up would be the top of her feet. So there's a Gummo anecdote, which are as rare as hen's teeth. But he was very pleasant. And I didn't have any, you know, if pictures of him are not easy to come by. So I didn't have anything for him to sign apart from a 3x5 card. And so he signed it and handed it back to me and said, you know, if my signature were at the bottom of a check, it might actually be worth something. So I met and or knew three of the five Marx Brothers, which is not a bad batting average.
No, not at all.
No, man, not at all. So what surprising things did you learn about the Marx Brothers while you were working for Groucho?
Well, one of the most surprising... I worked closely with a man named Hector Arce, who was Groucho's biographer. And he also worked with Groucho on a few books, The Groucho File, which is like a pictorial history of Groucho's life with Groucho doing the captions. And The Secret Word is Groucho, which was the backstage story of You Bet Your Life. And Hector and I interviewed all the staff of the show and some of the contestants. And that was a lot of fun. And in the course of putting together the Groucho File, we wanted to get a copy of Groucho's birth certificate just to establish once and for all October 2nd, 1890. So we got a photostat of it from the government. And I was looking it over and it said number of, let me see. No, it said number of children, 3, and number of previous children. I'm getting this wrong, but the point was it implied that there had been another brother before Chico and Harpo. And I thought it was just a mistake on the part of whoever filled out the thing. And I said to Hector, that if I'm reading this right, the previous and current shouldn't be the same. So we went into Groucho's bedroom and we said, did your parents have a kid before Chico? And Groucho said, yes, his name was Manfred. He died when he was a few months old.
Oh, wow.
And I said, what did he die from? And Groucho said, old age. And in fact, so there was, you know, when people say how many Marx Brothers were they, that ends up being an essay question. Because if they only have a cursory familiarity, they think 3. And if they've seen the movies, they think 4. And if they've really read up on it, they know that Gummo made it 5. But Manfred, and we would never have known what his personality would have been like as the oldest. So Chico became the oldest, but it was all because of this notation on the birth certificate on the number of previous and current children.
Mm. Well, in the book, you wrote about that, you know, you found deleted scenes from looking through old scripts. Were there any scripts from films that never got made that you found out? And so what were they about?
Well, there were scripts from films that got made, but weren't the scripts that got made. Particularly, Bert Calmer and Harry Ruby had written scripts for A Night at the Opera and for Go West that had a lot of funny stuff in them. But again, because of the Thalberg dictum that the Paramount films were joke, 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 and you can't hear because you're laughing. Their scripts weren't used. Now, the Go West was written by Irving Brecker, who is a very nice man, a very good friend of Groucho's for many years, funny man, co-wrote Meet Me in St. Louis, was one of many writers on Wizard of Oz, started the life of Riley on the radio and television. You know, he had credits. However, his Marx Brothers credits are at the Circus and Go West, which most fans would consider two of their weakest movies. And Brecker was very fond of bragging, you know, I wrote two Marx Brothers movies all by myself, and the others were written by a bunch of people. And I thought, yes, that's why they're not as good, because there wasn't anyone to say, Irv, better than that would be if he said, I don't understand why the da-da-da-da. So I remember from the Burt Calmer, Harry Ruby Go West, Groucho's flirting with a woman, and he says, it's women like you who make men like me make women like you, which would have been a very famous Groucho-ism, except he never said it. Also, he goes into an elevator and says, take me to the 13th floor. And the elevator operator says, we don't have a 13th floor. And Groucho says, all right, then I'll take me to the 14th and I'll walk down a flight. that is a cleverness of a high order that was in short supply in the finished version of Go West. Also, they took scenes from some of their films before they filmed them on the road to try them out in front of live audiences, which was Thalberg's idea. And that way they would know where to leave spaces for the audience to laugh. So if you watch Night at the Opera on TV, you wonder why there are these gaps or it takes too long on a reaction shot instead of saying something. If you see it with a theater full of people, it works better. So they would try it out and the writers would show up and take notes on what lines got big laughs, what lines needed work. And I was reading and then type up notes about, you know, their evaluation of how scenes had done. And I open it up and it was, they were trying out scenes from Go West. And it said, after Thursday night's performance, Harpo Marx walked up to the microphone and delivered the following speech. And I thought, wait a minute. Wait, the silent Marx brother. He didn't speak. What is? And it was this block of nonsense. And it was like unaccustomed as I am to this perspicacious reception of this monumental situation that all of, and then Groucho said, now you know why he never talks. The only people that heard that were the people in the audience that night, but one of the writers took that down as something that, and it was a revelation to not only hear that Harpo had spoken, but what he had to say that night. So yeah, there were surprises. In addition to the fact that I'm spending quality time, I was always welcome at the lunch table or dinner table if I was still there. There was no sense of, you know, the help will eat in the kitchen. It was like, what, no matter who was coming over, or if no one was coming over, and it was just Groucho and me, or Groucho and Aaron and me, or the nurse. So I was able to very comfortably spend time either eavesdropping on their conversation or participating when George Burns and Jack Lemmon and Steve Allen and Red Buttons and Maury Riskin and, I mean, Nat Perrin, and all these names that I'd seen roll by in their movies, or that I knew being an old movie buff. And I don't know if you guys have had the experience of meeting someone when you're young and then later on appreciating who they were and thinking, oh, I wish I had known that at the time. In my case, because of my obsessive fandom, and fan, of course, comes from fanatic. It's just a brief form of it. I knew who all these people were as they were introduced to me. My brain would flip to the Rolex card. Nat Perrin, yes, you co-wrote Monkey Business and Duck Soup, and you co-created the Addams Family TV show, and Groucho's nickname for you was the Deacon because of the glasses you wore. And so they would look at me like, this, I'm sure this punk has no idea who us Alta Cockers are. And instead, as I would shake their hand, it's like, yeah, you, and it's like, hey, this, he knows this stuff. So that was really cool. That was gratifying. And now, of course, now that I'm the old guy, now when someone says, my granddaughter was watching Monkey Business and she was laughing at this, now it warms the cockles of my heart. And because I accept the fact that many, many people under 50 cannot place the name Groucho or the Marx Brothers. So if I'll, you know, people will ask, what's your book about? Or, you know, what do you do for a living or something? And I will say, have you ever heard of a comedy team called the Marx Brothers? I love nothing more than to have them say, of course I do. Do you think I'm stupid? Because too often I get nothing. There's just, and I've got to spend varying amounts of time if I feel like it trying to explain. So now I'm the old guy that thinks you kids don't know who they are. And then when I hear from one that does, it's like, and so each generation passes the torch. You know, but one of the things that frustrates me is now that all of these films and You Bet Your Life and Rare Appearances and stuff are readily available on YouTube or bonus footage and featured discs and stuff, it's a cinch for a younger person to access it, but because there's so much material out there at their fingertips, it asks a lot of them to sit still for an old black and white movie where they don't understand the references. God forbid you plunk them in front of a silent movie or the worst, a radio show, a Jack Benny show, or even like one of Orson Welles' dramatic shows. It's like, why would we want to be handicapped by not being able to see or hear, or we don't know what color their shirt is? So even though it's more, you know, readily available than when I had to sit and look through the TV guide and will myself to stay awake till 3 a.m., they're not looking at it. And I've gotten past becoming a curmudgeon that says, hey, if these kids don't want to discover the Marx Brothers, fuck them. They can have Adam Sandler and I'm not, I don't care. And I'll just take their movies and be buried with them. And that, and it, you know, there's no point in it.
Yeah.
And it's this bridge that burns behind me. I remember Dick Cavett telling me once about making a reference to someone who had been on the Ed Sullivan show, and the person he was talking to didn't know who the guest was. But now it's to the point where they don't know who Ed Sullivan is, unless they've seen maybe the Elvis clip or the Beatles.
Mm. Well,
so I've gotten past. You should know these things. When I was your age, I knew who Chester Conklin was. I knew who Mark Twain was. Why don't you know who these people are? It's like, all right, fine.
Well, well, back to Groucho.
Yes.
Well,
yes,
he's still relevant to us. What were some stories he shared with you about Chico and Harpo?
Harpo really did seem to play an appropriate instrument. No one has ever come up with any kind of slanderous or mean or petty thing. And Groucho said that Harpo and his wife Susan adopted enough children so that there could be one in each window waving goodbye to him when he went to work. I think it's just the sweetest thing. And, you know, Chico, Groucho had stories about his womanizing and you know, he said
he would just walk up to a girl and say, I want to fuck you. And 9 times out of 10, they'd tell him to go to hell. But that 1 time out of 10 was enough. So, I mean, apparently he was a compulsive gambler.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to have been rough to be his wife or his daughter, Maxine. Now, Maxine wrote a book called Growing Up with Chico. And she adored her father. And she sticks up for him all throughout the book. But it had to have been difficult with a serial philanderer father who also basically couldn't stand to have any money in his pocket. He would bet a cab driver which of 2 raindrops would hit the bottom of the windshield first. He would throw away good cards in a card game to make it more exciting. There was a story that Chico gave someone a check and said, cash this Monday at noon. And the guy saw him the next week and said, that check bounced. And he said, when did you cash it? And he said, no, about 12:30 the day. He said, I told you to cash it at noon. And the other brothers, you know, Groucho said he and Harpo were always having to bail him out. But they loved him, and he just was a rascal. Mostly I wanted to just quiz Groucho. Again, because of my passion for history, not only was he someone who was that same man with a black grease paint mustache whirling around Margaret Dumont, but he knew James Thurber and George Gershwin and Irving Berlin. And I mean, these giant figures from long ago that exist only in black and white in my mind. And then he was this, as I say, a man from 1890 whose firsthand memories went from before the Wright brothers to after the moon landings.
Mm-hmm.
And he would share stories that brought long ago times. The brothers were appearing, I think they were appearing in their first stage hit, Alsatian. And the day that Warren Harding died, the president, in 1923, he said, we were playing a theater that had an aluminum roof. And all through the performance, all you could hear was the sound of raindrops hitting the aluminum roof, because there wasn't a laugh in the theater, because everybody was sad because the president had died. And it's like, here's this vivid image that he brought to life of one random evening at the theater in 1923. I mean, he, as you may know, the Marx Brothers started out as singers and only gradually added comedy and funny songs to their act. But Groucho was already enough of not a draw, but he was employed as a singer and did all right with that before his brothers and he joined up. And he actually sang at the Metropolitan Opera House at a special benefit performance on the same bill as Enrico Caruso. And the proceeds went to benefit the victims of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. So he was this living link to this vast swath of American and world history, in addition to knowing all of these people on a first name basis. So it was a remarkable dream come true. In my case, literally, because I used to dream about meeting Groucho before I met him. And they would be vivid dreams, and I would ask him for a cigar and say something, as I would wake up, it would start to dissolve, and I'd think, damn, this, I was sure, it was tangible, it had to have been real, and it wasn't real. Mm. I knew, you know, from the Dorothy Chandler, from the condition he was in, that I would never meet him. And then what I came to realize when I went to work for him was, despite the strokes and hardening of the arteries and, you know, just being a 19th century man, or 19th century man, there was much that was still there, humor-wise and wisdom-wise. It was a lot easier for him to say things at the lunch table than with a spotlight on him and thousands of people hanging on his every word. So, and then I would run into the next room and scribble things down that he said. And those are included in my book that would otherwise have just been, you know, lost to the ages, because that just was, you know, and it was so heartwarming when you would say something to him and he would twist it and hand it back to you, just as he would have, you know. I mentioned in the book that he even though he was semi-retired, he still kept up with what was happening in Hollywood and with his peers. And so he always looked forward to getting the Hollywood trade papers in the mail. And when the mail would arrive, I would go through it and then bring him the things that I figured he'd want to see. And one day he said, "Wonderful mail you brought me, nothing but requests for money." And I said, "But you got a variety, didn't you?" "Yes, a variety of requests for money." Which, you know, he would have said that at any point in his life. Or he got a tin of candied almonds for Christmas one year from Fred Allen's widow, Portland Hoffa. And as he walked past my room, my office room at his house, he said, "By the way, send one of the Christmas cards to Fred Allen's widow." And I said, "Don't you want to say anything personal?" And he said, "Well, tell her thanks for the nuts. Hope you're the same." So, you know, it's like, that's just how he expressed himself. But he was also a serious man that was a voracious reader, and he always cherished the company of writers more than, quote, famous people. At MGM, he would sit at the writer's table on the commissary, because it meant nothing to him to, "Ooh, I'm sitting with Clark Gable or Joan Crawford." He wasn't starstruck, and he tended to think of stars as kind of vacuous and self-involved, but writers were bright and informed and clever, and they could talk politics or gossip or whatever. So he really thrived on the company of writers more than movie stars.
I do want to ask about Erin Fleming. You know, you wrote about a lot about her in the book.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of unflattering things written about her, and even in your book, there's like so many different perspectives. So, what were some of your experiences with her regarding that?
Well, people have asked me about, understandably, have asked me about her. And I've said, as a rule, whatever you've heard about her is probably true. If you heard that she came along at a time in his life when his children couldn't really devote themselves to looking after him, that is true. If you've read that she had a lot to do with keeping him in the public eye and making him an even bigger star late in life, that is true. And if you heard that he was, I've never met anyone in a position to have a valid opinion that really thought there was anything physical between them. I think she was more arm candy, and he was very fond of her, but I don't think she was his quote girlfriend. But, you know, if they heard that Groucho was crazy about her, that was true, too. If they heard that she had a volatile temper and could run hot and cold, that was true. If they heard that she would scream at Groucho that caused his blood pressure to shoot dangerously high, that was true. If they heard that she just refused to cope with his mortality, thinking that if she yelled and shook him she could keep the rust away and somehow triumph over the fact that he was a man in his late 80s with a bad heart and bad circulation. So it was a real challenge. I had never dealt with anyone that had a really volatile personality before. I grew up in a very middle of the road household where there weren't dirty words. My dad didn't have to yell. All he say was, "All right, that's enough." And that tone of voice was enough to let me know. Aaron was a screamer and a door slammer and a cusser. And I came to find out later on that she was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, which does not mean split personality. The schism is between her reality and everyone else's reality. So she did feel like people were out to get her. Occasionally they were, but sometimes we'd think, oh God, if Aaron finds out about this, she's going to have a shit fit. And we would tell her and she would go, "Oh yes, that's just Sydney." And then other times we'd think something was completely innocuous and she just, it became Cruella de Vil, hiring and firing. One day she at lunch, Groucho turned to her and said, "What's the matter? Aren't you feeling well today?" And she said, "Yes, why?" "You haven't fired anyone." So he knew on some level. And, you know, those of us in the household cared about Groucho, and it hurt to see her being at least verbally and emotionally abusive, screaming at him. He'd have a coughing fit and she would scream at him to stop it. She couldn't stand that sound. "Stop it, Methuselah." And it's like, he's not coughing on purpose. He had a slight stroke on her birthday one year, and she accused him of doing it on purpose to keep the spotlight on him. I mean, you know, she was a threat to his health, and yet we also wondered if somehow subtracting her from the equation wouldn't be harder on him than keeping it as it is, because if you just grab the syringe away from the junkie and say, "Deal with it," it can, the shock can kill them. And Groucho was old and frail and had grown, as he grew weaker, he grew more dependent on her decision-making. And it was a, you know, as I mentioned in the book, there was a French writer named André Gide who said, "The color of truth is gray." And as I've gotten older, which I clearly have, I find that it's really, really true. Things are very rarely up or down. People are very rarely heroic or all villainous. There's, you know, and also, you know, if you're writing a screenplay, the best characters are the, you know, the heroes with flaws and the villains that have some charm to them, you know, like Dr. Professor Moriarty to Sherlock Holmes, you know, this refined, well-mannered fellow. And so Aaron is a complex figure, and I'll run into people who will say, "I hope when I'm his age, I find someone like that." And I sit them down and I explain why they are wrong. And then the people who say, she was just horrible. She was just evil and just was just the worst thing. And then I bolster the other side and say, however, where was Arthur? Where was Miriam? Where was Melinda? He was, his last wife had left him. And he was just rattling around in his big house in Beverly Hills. And she picked him up and dusted him off and put him out there, which many of his close friends held against her because it exposed him to the harsh scrutiny of seeing how old and frail he'd gotten, but he loved an audience. He loved to sing. He loved, you know, at his parties, he would sing. As long as someone could play the piano, he was happy to sing. I remember he sang for a reporter that came to interview him, and the reporter said, "Where'd you learn to sing?" And Groucho said, "I've been singing all my life. Where'd you learn to write? Or maybe you haven't." They didn't call him Groucho for nothing.
Oh, man. Well, what were Groucho's last months like?
Again, a bifurcation in my answer. In one sense, they were smooth because Aaron was no longer in charge of him. There had been a court case over conservatorship between Aaron and then his son Arthur and his side. And it had come out that, I was going to say, if you put this in a movie, no one would believe it, except we're putting it in the movie because there is going to be a film version of my book with Jeffrey Rush as Groucho. But I digress.
Oh, wow.
My gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Aaron, in her paranoia, hired two private detectives to scan the house because she was certain that Arthur Marx had bugged the house to get information on her, which was rubbish. But she hired these guys to do a thorough job inside and outside. So they came back and they found absolutely nothing, but they did find a baggie with empty syringes and some pills in the storm drain in front of Groucho's house. And they said, "What should we do with this?" And she said, "Bury it in the backyard, of course." And they thought, I don't feel comfortable doing that. So instead, they went to the police, who launched an investigation that led to headlines. It's like, here I was living with this knowledge of all of the goings on with Aaron and her craziness and real and imagined enemies and any number of prescription and recreational drugs that she would take. And now I'm picking up the LA Times and reading, "Nurse accuses Groucho companion of drugging and abuse." And this blew up into this thing that turned into the fight for conservatorship. So temporarily, the judge appointed Nat Perrin, who was, again, one of Groucho's old writers and oldest friends, who also had a law degree. And both sides thought that that was very fair because he didn't seem biased in either direction. And he brought order to the chaos of the household. And actually, on weekends, he appointed me to stay at the house sort of as a traffic cop to the factions, the Aaron and her group of friends and Arthur and his group of friends, excuse me, and when they would come by to visit so they didn't bump into each other because there was so much acrimony. So his last months were relatively tranquil because there were people in charge that were rational and looking out for his best interest. However, my hero was fading out down the hall, and there had been so many false alarms, you know, Groucho having a stroke or Groucho blood pressure or something like that. And I would think, that's it. The coach turns back into a pumpkin, the horses turn back into mice, and I've had a remarkable few months or year and a half. And he kept beating death and bouncing back. And finally, it's just like the spiral was slowly going down. In early 77, he fell and broke his hip and was confined to a wheelchair. And it just sort of went downhill after that. And he died in August of 1977. And, you know, there was a certain sense of he's better off now. But the greedy kid in me was mourning also the loss of this astonishing ride that I'd been on for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And my last day there was the weekend after. I think he died on a Thursday, so I was there that weekend just to tying up loose ends. And I remember the phone rang, and it was Betty Comden, who was half of the writing team of Comden and Green that wrote the screenplays for Singing in the Rain and Bandwagon. And she was a longtime friend of Groucho. And she didn't know me from, I was just the guy that answered the phone. And she said, "Is Aaron there?" And I said, "No." She said, "Is Arthur there?" And I said, "No." And she said, "I don't know who to console." And I said, "I guess we should console ourselves." Which is, I mean, it was the best I could think of, but in retrospect was essentially true. There had been such polarization, and, you know, which side are you on and which side are you on? And Groucho had bowed out. And so each of us was left with his or her own feelings and memories. And it's like, don't waste them on a crazy woman and a son who had had big ups and downs with his father his whole life.
Was Groucho aware? I mean, I no. Obviously he was, but of his place in film history. I mean, was he?
I thought you were going to ask if he was aware of the turmoil, which mercifully we were able to keep from him. Oh. He had a healthy opinion of himself, which is fine. One of the things I admired most about him was his generosity when it came to jokes. Because there is a very strong gravitational pull when you hear a funny line of just sort of acquiring it and using it as if you had come up with it. It's very tempting, and comedians often steal from each other. Groucho was meticulous about saying, you know, Robert Benchley had a very funny line, or, you know, Woody Allen had a very funny line. George Kaufman once said, if he heard something funny, he was, I guess he was confident enough in his own skills and knowledge that he didn't need to take it and pass it off as his own. He was strong enough to say, that wasn't my line, that was his. He appreciated all of the adoration of the young people. I don't think he saw himself in the perspective of, you know, film history or comedy history. I don't think he looked at it that way. But it meant a lot to him that he was hot again after all this time. When we were at UCLA that first time and the reporters were asking him questions, one reporter said, "What do you think of all of the adulation of the younger generation?" And Groucho said, "Well, I'm flattered by it. Last Halloween, three kids came to the door dressed as Groucho, Harpo, and Chico. And I said, 'What did you give them?' And he said, 'I sent for the police.'" So, there you have it.
Actually, are you still in contact with anyone from the Marx family or no?
I'm in very sporadic touch with Groucho's grandson, Andy, and also Harpo's son, Bill, who's a great guy, great piano player. You'd think, oh, well, he must have inherited it, but all of Harpo's children were adopted. So it was nurture, not nature, I guess. And there's still a couple people from the household that I've stayed in touch with. But, you know, it occurs to me as I rocket towards 70, which blows what's left of my mind, that I am one of the vestiges of that time. I mean, it just as I treasured Groucho telling me firsthand stories about things that happened at the turn of the century, people's jaw drop when I talk about knowing or meeting these people from, you know, vaudeville and radio, and early motion pictures, and that I could say that I knew Groucho Marx. It wasn't like I had a selfie taken with him, although I did, but it wasn't a selfie. It was, you know, he was, I won't go so far as to say we were friends, because I think that overstates it. But I was more than just an employee. I would say he was fond of me like a nephew, and he appreciated that I appreciated him and his world. One time he called me into his bedroom and he handed me a 20 and he said, go down to Tower Records and buy me some records. You know what I like. And I thought, oh, that's so gratifying. He knows that I know what he likes. He didn't have to explain to this kid. So, you know, we had, it was just, I wouldn't have traded a moment of it. It, you know, I mentioned Dorothy opening the door into Oz. At the end, she says something like, I remember some of it wasn't very nice, but most of it was beautiful. That's how I would sum up my Groucho year.
Oh, my gosh. That's perfect. Well, did you have any contact with Erin Fleming during the last years of her life?
My last actual contact with her was within a year after he died. I got a job working in the steno pool at Universal on typing on a Selectric 2, which was state of the art. It had liftoff tape. You didn't have to use whiteout. Anyway, from 11 to 8, typing up Kojaks and Columbos and Rockford Files and $6 Million Man. And a woman from a magazine had interviewed me about Groucho's final years. And as I tried to do with the book, I neither crucified anyone, nor did I pull punches. I just tried to tell the truth. And I got a call from Erin, and it was the first time I had heard that voice in about a year. And she said, I understand that you spoke with a woman about a magazine article, and you said some things about me, which is true. And she said, I think what you should do is call her up and tell her that you may have been mistaken. And it's one of those things, it's like one of the reasons it's so hard to get Trump is because he would talk like a mob boss and say, you'll take care of that, won't you? And mob bosses don't say, please take him out into a field and pull out a gun and shoot him in the back of the head. They say, take care of that problem. And it was like a bad movie. Erin Fleming saying, I think you, and then she said, it would be a shame to ruin your life and career at this point over something like this. And it was like, if you saw a transcript of that, at no point was it a threat, but it sure. And then she said, I know Groucho would want that. And I thought, that decides it. I'm sticking to my guns. I'm not taking back anything. How dare you drag his body out of the crypt and prop it up and say, see, he says you shouldn't say things. And that was the last time I heard. Now, my book, Raised Eyebrows, initially came out in 1996. And I had been waiting to hear what her response was to it, because even though I say a lot of, you know, half the people say, you were too rough on her, and half say you went too easy on her. So I guess I hit the right balance. But I thought, what is she going to do when she reads my detailed description of her descent into madness and the abusive things and all that? And finally, years later, I talked to someone who had remained in sporadic touch with her, and she'd been in and out of psych units at hospitals. She'd lost a case that the Bank of America had brought against her, that she had finagled Groucho out of money and gifts, and the jury foreperson said that she was her own worst enemy in her testimony, but she was broke and couldn't pay any of it back. She really was, you know, down and out in Beverly Hills, essentially. People would see her on the street with a shopping cart. I mean, it really was a hard fall for her. And now I forgot the point I was in the midst of making. Oh, waiting to hear what she thought of the book. And sure enough, I heard from someone, and it's like in one of the board and care facilities she was living in, they had a circulating library with other places, and my book showed up, and he said, "Well, Aaron read your book." And I thought, do I hire security? Do I change the locks on it? And he said her response was, "There's a lie on every page." And I thought, gee, I wish I'd gotten that as a dust jacket blurb instead of those frivolous comments from Woody Allen and Dick Cavett and Steve. And the other was, she said, Steve wrote that I sold him my Pinto for $1,500. And that's not right. I sold it to him for $1,200. I said, that's all she said? He said, yeah. And I said, I can't believe, I mean, it's a detailed account of her abuse of this man and her descent into madness. And she's quibbling over the cost of her car. I said, that's like a former Nazi official watching Schindler's List and saying, this is nothing but a tissue of lies. For one thing, the camp commandant had his SS insignia on the left lapel instead of the right lapel. It's all rubbish. And I talked to my therapist, and he said her response was exactly what you would expect of someone with her psychological disorders, that they would focus on the micro and miss the macro.
Mm.
So I never did have any contact with her. And then a sad ending. She shot herself. She was living in a, again, this sounds too contrived to be true, but it's true. She was living in a board and care facility almost directly beneath the Hollywood sign.
Yeah.
And one night she stuck a pistol in her mouth and pulled the trigger. She left, and that was in 2003. She left no note. Her brother Russell came down from Canada, where she came from, and had her cremated and took the ashes back to Canada. And nothing more has surfaced about what the last straw was. But that's often the case with suicides. You're not sure, how did they decide today is the day that I don't want to see tomorrow?
Hmm.
We'll never know, but you know, her life wasn't a happy one. And I know I've heard from people that said she was basically okay if she stayed on her meds, but she would go off her meds and her rocker at the same time. So sorry, it's not a happy ending, but
I want to touch you. I mean, you've definitely surrounded yourself with legends. That's what I want to ask next. You mentioned, and I mentioned at the top, that he blurbed your book, Woody Allen. And I always think of Woody Allen, you know, because my father introduced me to him. And so his movies mean so much to me because of that. we used to watch them together. So how did that friendship come about for you? And do you still have a lot of interaction with him today?
I haven't heard from Woody Allen since last week. He just turned 88.
Right.
We write letters. Remember letters?
Yes.
And he still uses the same Olympia portable manual that he was given as a high school graduation gift. Mm-hmm. And on that one machine, he wrote his jokes for his stand-up act, the first drafts of all of his scripts, and letters to me. He still hates to change the ribbon. He apologized for not having written sooner, but said the typewriter needed repairing, and typewriter repairmen are few and far between in this city. He just turned 88, and he said 88 is a very lovely age, particularly if you don't mind dying. And he said, now that I'm 88, I have applied for dementia. Which it's like what a classic Woody Allen type line. I don't know how to do this in a short amount of time because we've already been chatting for over an hour and a half. But in shorthand, and here's where you should get out your umbrella. I'm going to drop names all over the place. From Groucho, I became friends with Dick Cavett from writing him a letter during the Groucho years, and we struck up a correspondence. And then when Groucho died, I figured, well, I'm no longer a pipeline into Groucho's intrigue, so what will Dick Cavett want to do with me now that he's gone? And instead, Cavett called me that the week Groucho died and said, listen, I hope just because Groucho's gone, we're not going to lose touch. By the way, I hope you don't mind, but I've shown some of your letters to Woody, and he says they're very well written. So I emptied the urine out of my shoes after that phone call. And so Cavett and I kept corresponding. Then he hired me to write for him at HBO in New York in 1982. So I moved from being a secretary at Universal to being this writer from Los Angeles, as far as HBO was concerned. And lived in New York for 2.5 years and just completely devoured the Manhattan experience. I loved it. Ever since working for Groucho, I was crazy about the whole Algonquin Round Table Broadway literary witty critic thing. And spent all sorts of quality time with Cavett bumming around town and all this. And I knew he had been friends with Woody since the early 60s. And I had not been pushing to meet Woody because, as usual, I felt there's nothing I can say that he would care about or hasn't heard 100 times. And having seen Stardust Memories, I felt he had contempt for either the fans who intellectualize his films or the drooling fans that say, I've seen him 100. And it's like I fell into one or both of those camps at different times. And so I never, you know, he would say, Woody and I went for a walk in Central Park, and I never would say, can I go next time? And then one day, Cavett called me and he said, I just discovered that Woody is shooting his new movie in a building around the corner from my apartment. So I thought if you came over, we could just sort of happen upon him and then you could meet him. And I said, and he won't mind? He said, oh, I didn't say that. He may very well say, really, Dickie, I wish you hadn't. So I thought, well, this is great. I've been afraid of meeting him all this time. And now you're saying he may not like it. So I went over and we went in, and it was one of those buildings that doubled as apartments and offices. And we went up to a floor that was a suite of medical offices. And we walked through the reception area, and there's equipment and lights and people with clipboards and so on. And then, and it sounds like I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. There was a long hallway that had examination rooms left and right. And at the furthest end, one of the doors was open, and out of that door was a bright light emulating. It sounds like something, again, out of The Wizard of Oz. But like there was a glow, and Cabot said, stay here, let me check it out. So he goes walking down, and he's standing in the hallway looking into the room where the bright light is. And then the light goes out, and Woody Allen and Mia Farrow walk out of the room and start talking to Cabot. And I'm thinking, wow, Woody Allen and Mia Farrow and Dick Cabot are talking. And then at one point, I see Cabot talk to them and then point in my direction. And I did the me. And Woody, again, he knew who I was because I was the guy, Cabot's friend that had worked for Groucho. And the conversation between the four of us was notable for being unremarkable. It was actually very comfortable. There was nothing momentous said. I had just seen Manhattan on TV and was talking about the widescreen versus pan and scan letterbox. And I had just seen Zelig. That was his then current film. And he said, you know, I wrote a letter to Greta Garbo asking if she would be one of the on-camera interviewees about Zelig. And I knew it was a long shot, but I said, we can shoot it wherever you want, whenever you want. You can have complete control over what you say. I'll show it to you when we're done. And if you don't like it, we'll throw it away. I'll show you the film after we're done. And if you don't like the clip, I'll take it out. All on your terms. He said, I never heard back. And Cabot said, well, did you send it to 459 East 53rd Street? And he said, yeah. And I said, you probably put the wrong apartment number on. And he said, that was probably, it's like, oh, well, you said Greta Garbo 2B and she's in 2C. So, you know, we have no idea where to deliver this. And the movie was a little something called Hannah and Her Sisters.
Mm.
And it's the scene where in a flashback, he and Mia go to a doctor's office and are told they can't have children. He's wearing a bowling shirt. And the bowling shirt had the name of the bowling alley. It had on the back of it, it had like bowling shirts have an advertisement for some company and the phone number. And I said, was that made for the film? He said, no, they found this at a thrift shop. And I said, you know, that the phone number isn't 555. There's a real phone number on the back. And now people are going to call it when they see the movie. And he kind of thought like, oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Oh, no.
But now when I see that movie, I can see the day I met him because it was just a brief scene in that movie. And then work dried up in New York, and I got an offer to work on as a writer on a TV show in LA. So I moved back, but I struck up a correspondence with Woody, and we're still, I mean, it's been decades, and he has been so supportive. The blurb on the book wasn't even something I sought. He wanted to read the manuscript ahead of time, and I sent it, and he sent me this just astonishing letter saying, it's written with real wit, you should be proud, it's bursting with live anecdotes that are funny and interesting and fascinating insight into the family dynamics, and it's one of the best books about a show business icon I've ever read. I thought, I don't believe this. I saw you and Take the Money and Run in 1969, and now you're saying that I wrote a good book. Oh, and before I had sent him the manuscript, I had sent him a letter saying I'm working on a book about my Groucho years, and he sent me a letter back saying, I think it's great that you're writing a Groucho book. There's never really been a great one. And I thought, oh, that's what I need. Pressure that Woody Allen is thinking this is going to be the great book. And darn if he doesn't continue to sing its praises when it was reissued in 2012 with a new cover and a new final chapter, catching people up on what happened. He was talking to our mutual friend, Bob Whitey, who did a marvelous documentary on Woody Allen and also did a Curb Your Enthusiasm. And he did a great Marx Brothers documentary called Marx Brothers in a Nutshell. And Bob told me the other day, Woody said, Stolyar's book is still the best thing written on Groucho. And I thought, ooh, an unsolicited compliment. I can't believe it. And he's just been so supportive. And I have to mention this. My admiration for him has only grown as I've seen how he has navigated the hit job that the Farrow Gang has done on him. And this is, you know, this subject deserves a lot more than I can do in a couple of minutes. But all I'll say is that my late wife had been horrifically sexually abused by her father and brother when she was a kid. And she knew that this was Mia's revenge. If anyone could have been forgiven for wanting to side with the accuser, it would have been my wife, given her background and all the "we don't believe you" that you run into. She knew that profile-wise, you don't have a completely clean life, and then in your late 40s, you suddenly molest your infant daughter once and then never again. That's not the pattern. Also, the misconceptions about Soon Yi, she was not his daughter, not his stepdaughter, not his adopted daughter. She was not, he didn't even act in a parental role. It was always Andre Previn. Woody's great at compartmentalizing. Her brood was always the children of whoever she was married to when they either adopted or had them. And he never even spent the night at Mia Farrow's place. It was always very carefully. So also now he and Soon Yi have been married for many years. She's in her late middle age. They adopted two daughters, which of course no agency would have ever, ever given the okay to that if the kids were ever believed to be at peril. And I have watched Woody and Soon Yi and their kids interact, and they're remarkably functional. There are so many dysfunctional families. The Farrow family, on the other hand, has had nothing but alcoholism, suicide, drug abuse, divorce. It's jaw-dropping. Mia's brother is in prison for child molestation. She actually brainwashed poor little Dylan into believing that the molestation happened. And I suspect Dylan now would pass a lie detector test because it has been so deeply ingrained in her. And it's sad because Mia is the abuser. She sacrificed her daughter because Woody stole Soon Yi, even though they're happily married. And Soon Yi literally credits Woody with saving her life by getting her out of the compound, the Farrow atmosphere, because her stepsisters and brothers, there was drug addiction, there was suicide, profound depression. I mean, Mia was ruled with an iron fist. There was an obsession with pleasing her. It's a terrible portrait. And it's, you know, Woody said his ace in the hole is knowing that he's innocent. To me, that would be the worst part, because life would be this Kafkaesque nightmare of being punished for something you didn't do. I would want to stop people on the street and say, hi, you don't know me, but let me explain something that happened. My ex-girlfriend has been wreaking vengeance on me without any grounds for it. And you need to understand the circumstances of this, A, B, C, D, E. But for him, it's like he compared it to Trumpers saying they will never accept that the election wasn't stolen. He said, no amount of incontrovertible evidence will ever convince the people that believe he's a child molester that he isn't. And it has, Mia has succeeded in arbuckling him in terms of America and Hollywood. But if she set out to ruin his life, she failed miserably, because I would say from my vantage point, Woody is the most content he has ever been in his life. He has a loving family, good friends, ample money. He's constantly creating. He writes plays, short stories, books, screenplays. He's got another screenplay. It's like he said, the Italians found out that I shot a movie in France in French, and now they want me to shoot a movie in Italy in Italian. And he's not sure, but so even though it takes a while for them to reach America, he said even in his heyday, most of his revenue from films was from a worldwide distribution. It wasn't from the American box office. So he can't stop creating. He's just a constant, and he said, and if I can't get financing for a movie, then I'll write novels. Or, the way that the rest of us would say, well, if I can't get a sandwich, then I'll have pasta. He can't stop creating. And he is a remarkable 88-year-old person with an astonishing resume. And I do yell and type myself hoarse trying to explain to people that no, it's not because he's a friend of mine and I believe him. No, it's not because I'm a guy that I don't believe the girl, because my wife didn't believe it either. And I'm sure a lot of people go, yeah, fine. And there's nothing I can do about it. But it infuriates me that he has been just crucified out of what Dick Cavett calls Mia's pathological vengeance.
Mm. Like I said, I'm always have a soft spot just because it means so much, because I grew up watching it with my dad, so I'll always associate with that, with Woody Allen's movies, that time spent together. So before we let you go, I want to know what you're working on next.
My main focus is on the film, because no pun intended.
And when is that coming out? Do you know?
Well, we haven't shot it yet. It's always important to, you may want to write this down. It's always important to make the film before releasing it.
Got it. Okay.
There's surprise endings, but that's, anyway, we hope to film it this year. I wrote the initial draft, and then it has been co-written and will be directed by a wonderful guy called Oren Moverman, who's an Oscar-nominated writer and director. And we are literally on the same page. At no point did he say, hey, you know what would be great is if Groucho dreams he's on Venus. it's like he has remained true to the book, and script revisions always get run past me first, and I actually send him notes. It's been a very rare experience for the writer of the initial work to be respected like that, instead of just, here, Sonny, here's some money, we'll invite you and a friend to the premiere. And so I'm co-exec producing, and I'm very much in the loop. And so, at some point, if all of our ducks are lined up, Wyatt Duck, correctly, I will be standing on a stage watching a reenactment of an important, vital part of my life, watching people play people I knew and someone playing me at 20.
Mm.
which is whatever meta means, that's ultimate. Watching a movie that's based on part of your life, of a book you wrote and a script you wrote, with people playing people you knew, including someone playing you. It's a mirror within a mirror within a mirror. I should also say that Amazon has the Kindle and audiobook versions of Raised Eyebrows. And yes. Big surprise, I did the audiobook and all the voices.
Well, your Groucho's fantastic, I'll say that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, it's amazing.
Kids usually stop me on the street and demand that I do my S.J. Perelman impression. That's the one that always gets them. Anyway, if they want to get a signed, personalized copy, you can order one from me at my website, which is stolier.com. And I will be happy to sign and send it in your general direction. Well, that was 2 hours.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It was such a treat to get to talk to you and hear all your stories. Like I said, I love the book. I read it this week. And I definitely recommend everyone getting it, because it was just so, I was so engrossed. I was telling Ike beforehand, I just like, just kept pouring through it.
So, I know. There's two compliments I love getting. One is, I hate you. Because I would have hated me too if I'd heard there was this guy that got to work. The other is, you owe me 8 hours of sleep, because I kept saying, I'll just read to this part, and then now I want to see what happens. And I have the chapters in sort of bite size.
Yes.
You know, I hate it when it's like, how many more pages to the end of this chapter? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. Oh shit. But in mine, they're sort of chopped up conveniently and logically, so you can just, it's like, all right, I'll do 2 more, and then before they know it, they're in the index.
The book, guys, is again Raised Eyebrows, and again, Steve, thank you so much. Really, it's such a treat, such a pleasure. This has been Pop Culture Retro. I'm Jonathan Rosen with Ike Eisenman. Again, a very special thanks to Steve Stolier, and please like, comment, and subscribe.
Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Retro, where no one was hurt during the making of this podcast.